Hello and welcome to the Screen Composer Studio, a podcast about the musical storytellers behind some of your favorite films, shows, video games, and more. I'm your host, Adrian Ellis. Originally from Hamilton, Ontario, Carly Paradis has made a name for herself as a first-call screen composer, scoring huge TV hits such as the BAFTA-nominated Line of Duty, Sick Note, and Netflix's The Innocents. After a stint in Toronto's burgeoning indie rock scene in the mid-2000s, a cold email to Clint Mansell on MySpace turned into an opportunity to work with the famed composer on his score for Moon, and to tour with his ensemble. This led her to making London, UK her home base, and from there she has built an enviable career writing for top-shelf film, TV, and trailer projects. She also finds time to write and produce her own albums, including her latest, Nothing Is Something, and most recently, to land the job as the touring keyboard player for Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. We chat about her minimalist studio approach, surviving the pandemic, her art school and songwriter roots, working with the London Contemporary Orchestra, her work on the massive British hit and cultural touchstone that is Line of Duty, how she funds and creates her ambitious albums, using unsung imagined lyrics to guide her scoring, and much more. If you like what you hear, please consider giving us a rating and sharing the episodes with your friends and followers. It really helps us grow and share the stories of these amazing creators. And now, please enjoy this conversation with a fantastic Carly Paradis. Let's do just a quick slate. Although I don't think we need to slate because we won't be using video, but let's just do it just in case. So,
okay. Yeah. And are you in Toronto?
I'm in Hamilton.
You're in Hamilton.
Yeah.
I did not know. Why did I not know that? I thought you were in Toronto.
No, Hamilton. That's why the Hamilton connection.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I grew up on the Stony Creek Mountain.
Oh, cool.
I guess at the one end of the link.
It's really cool that you recorded some of your album at Grant Avenue.
Oh, I love it. They have got my favorite piano of all time. This Yamaha C7 from like, I don't know if it's like 1979 or something. It's just got the most beautiful touch, feel, and sound. That like if I could ever buy a piano, like that's my dream piano, is that specific one.
You know about the Brian Eno, Daniel Lanois connection to Hamilton, right? They did a ton of stuff together. If you're ever interested and you have the time, obviously maybe on the road, Mark Maron's conversation with Daniel Lanois about his time, especially in Hamilton, is absolutely incredible. It's so cool. The things that the seminal stuff they got up to, like the really, you know, like early days of Brian Eno and of course Lanois there together doing kind of crazy stuff is, and to know that that happened in Hamilton is so cool. All right. Well, we're sort of in already, but I'll welcome you again. Carly, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. And I'm sorry it took so long.
Oh, that's okay. I really appreciate you making the time because I know you're so busy on so many really, really cool projects. You were on Michael Price's Composer Coffee Break back in March of 2020.
Whoa.
And he was asking you about how you're dealing with the sort of early days. And I mean, it was really weird to go back to that, you know, 2 or 3 years later and sort of get that sense again of like how everyone was sort of just dealing with it. You had a very positive kind of upbeat attitude towards the whole thing. And you were sort of saying, you know, this is an opportunity for us to think of new and unique creative solutions and to figure out new ways of working with one another and on our own stuff. Do you find now, like looking back on that and how you came through those years, what kind of things have you changed? Has anything changed for you? Or you come up with new things that you're doing differently now?
Yeah, I think like with the technology side of stuff, the last few projects, I've worked with you know, the team and never met any human being in person.
Oh wow!
So that was when that started. Because in the pandemic when that hit, I lost everything in the matter of one day. Line of Duty Series 6 stopped filming, and that also was meant to do the world tour with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, and that got postponed. So that was my entire year all set up for work. So it was just like poof. But obviously it was like that for most people, especially in the music industry. And yeah, I was super lucky to get a three-parter called The Pembrokeshire Murders. I met with the director and we really hit it off. And so I was so lucky to get a job because they had filmed it and it was in the can. So, you know, they could edit it. We could do the post-production.
Right.
And that I've never to this day have still not met the director. We've only had Zoom chats, you know, and any of the producers, everybody. So it's just so odd that becomes the norm.
Right.
That it's literally no human contact, just through screen and audio.
Where are you a particular gregarious person? Like when you're out, like networking or in a public situation, are you comfortable with people in that setting? Or are you more introverted?
I think I've kind of grown up being a little bit of a shy person, but something that excites me is to, you know, push your comfort zone as well. So I think I've pushed myself throughout my career to try to, you know, be more comfortable and confident with meeting new people. And that's really how the work happens, is through people. You know, you make great relationships or do some really cool work, and then that kind of through word of mouth or through someone hearing your work, it, you know, passes it on into this web of other doors opening or other jobs or, you know, other artists to work with. So I think it's important to try to be open to that. But it's also, I mean, I don't know, I'm a social person. Like I like to hang with friends and family, and I think meeting new people is an exciting thing. So
do you feel that in some ways, I mean, even before the pandemic, composers are sort of at the tail end of everything. We're not in the trenches making stuff. They're sort of like, I always feel a little bit like an outsider. You know, they've had this whole experience, they get this really visceral experience of making this stuff and going through these ups and downs of production. Do you ever find like it's hard to sort of get in and feel like you're really, truly a deep part of the team?
I think there's always a bit of a grace period, especially if you're working with new people, and just to sort of, you know, figure out the communication and see how people work. And then, yeah, of course, you're coming right at the very ending. They've probably been on the project for a year since, you know, starting to write it or whatever, you know, the script stage is. They've been there a lot longer, and their energy, you know, getting towards the end, you know, the energy levels might be coming down a bit sometimes. So just try to be there to bring the energy up and help it get over the finish line.
What were your early days like? What was it like growing up and sort of your early musical foundations in Stony Creek / Hamilton?
My parents had a pretty cool record collection. So one big one for me was Elton John's Yellow Brick Road.
Right.
Love Lies Bleeding / Funeral for a Friend. It's like this 9 minutes of pure epic, every type of genre of music mixed together and, you know, mainly instrumental. And so for me, you know, as a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, my mind was blown to hear this kind of music and that this kind of music is on an album, like a record. So that's where I kind of think started to get the spark. And then my grandma, she had one of those at-home organs, and they had like the foot pedals and the keys lit up and showed what notes were on the keys, and they had like a cool little percussive drum machine in it. So I got to play on that, and I've got pictures of me, you know, sitting on my mom's lap or just crawling up there playing on those keys. That was kind of the first instrument, and I was lucky to be at a young age to be able to start to learn this tool.
And were your parents encouraging of your interest in music and your interest in sort of pursuing it as a career?
Well, my dad's French Canadian, and he comes from, you know, quite a big French family, and there's a lot of artists and painters, you know, musicians and that. But I never really grew up with them because they're from a different generation, and obviously we didn't live nearby. They brought home a keyboard to the house when I forget how old I was. I don't know, 8 or something. They brought it home, and I would start to play tracks off the radio on it by ear, and so they just could see that I, you know, had some ability with the tool. So they put me into piano lessons, and they bought me this amazing, it was like 100-year-old piano. It was so cool. So yeah, I started lessons and did the classical stream, but I always was more of wanting to sit and improvise at the piano, and I hated practicing, and I kind of didn't really connect with a lot of these men with gray hair, you know. It wasn't until Frédéric Chopin, I don't know if I can show you on my wall over there, but I've got a painting of Chopin.
Very nice. Looking a little bit there. Like Louis Riel, even. There's a Canadian connection there.
You know what's so funny? This, everybody that sees this painting says it looks like someone else.
Right.
So I've had like people ask if it's a comedian, if it's my husband, if it's like they just, everybody thinks that it's somebody else. But I chose the photo. It was like a real photograph of Chopin, and he was actually quite sick. So I think, you know, it probably wasn't his best look, but I love it.
he took the photo and was like, might delete later, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, Chopin really kept my fire burning to stay in classical, because right. It was the first composer in music where you could add feeling, you could add movement, you know, the sense of rubato, uh-huh. robbed time, yep. you know, and yep. I was like, now this is my kind of music and this is my kind of composer. So that's when I started, really getting into it. And then, you know, I knew I wanted to be creating music. I just didn't know where I fit. And I think, you know, it did take me some time to figure it out, but because I was doing writing mostly instrumental stuff, mm-hmm. you know, at 9, I was writing these little pieces on the piano. And my mom's cousin, he was working for Alliance Atlantis at the time.
Oh, wow. I don't think
that, I mean, he's in Shania Twain's autobiography. His name is mentioned in there.
Oh, wow.
But so he was more on like the business side. So, but he brought me to Toronto to my first conference thing.
Okay, wow.
Like, I must have been like, I could have been 19, or he showed me, you can go here and then listen to them talk, and then you can go ask questions and talk to them after. I made up these like little business cards.
Oh man.
it was so like early days for sure. me, but it was a great experience because it did show me like, this is how you meet other creatives and other people in the industry. And so that was really, really helpful.
Were you sort of shown that it's about the relationships and the creative side of it? I know that when I tell the story about networking early on, where I really just thought it was about shoving my business card in people's faces, and that was sort of how you did it, as opposed to like, no, like work on genuine relationship building. Hello.
Yeah. What's the big one? Canadian Music Week.
Canadian Music
Toronto.
Week, yeah.
I went to a lot of those, and those are really helpful too. Like just bringing stacks of CDs and like,
sure.
yeah, handing them out, but also studying like who the people you're listening to at the talks were, and seeing the people that you'd like to learn more from or have questions for. And then I would like, okay, this is not like stalkerish, but I would study the booklet that came
yeah.
for the conference, and I would like try to familiarize what they look like. So if I see them in the hall, I could be like, hey, so-and-so.
Oh, that's smart.
I'm a musician and da-da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, so I just, the more days that I went, it just kept getting, it's almost like you just get more relaxed and it
right.
becomes easier yeah. to be able to get into that flow of like, meeting people and connecting that.
Wow. That's so interesting. You started that so early and you were building those muscles. Cause I really think, as you say, you get even over the course of the week, it's getting easier, getting more used to it. And I think that's just like, it's exposure therapy. I still now when I go and network after the pandemic, I feel very sort of nervous about it, which is a yeah. weird feeling for me. Cause normally I'm like, I can talk to people. It's not a hard thing. but now it's like, oh, I'm totally out of practice. This is like a muscle. You have to keep working it.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, even just leaving my flat in the pandemic, I was nervous because it's like, oh right. my God, am I going to get in trouble
yeah.
to go to the shop? So I think, yeah, it's taken some time. And I think there's still like a ton of anxiety happening, you know, because it's been such a messy couple years, like, and just so isolating. I mean, I think composers have the superpower because we're already isolated all yeah. the time. So,
yeah,
you know, we're just working by ourselves.
It felt weird to tell people that, like, how are you doing? I was like, well, it's kind of business as usual in a lot of ways. Sorry about that.
Well, I know it is crazy, our job.
So you ended up studying at McMaster. And if I remember correctly, sort of almost with a fine art or a visual art sort of focus to start. Where did that come from? Was that sort of a sort of parallel thing as you're coming up? You have an interest in visual art, and what is that actually like? Is it design? Is it painting? What did that look like?
Yeah. So I also loved visual art and drawing, mm. and so I was even, you know, an art teacher to kids, you know, as a part time job.
Oh, wow.
And stuff.
Cool.
And so when I went to McMaster, well, actually, I applied at Sheridan College for illustration. I didn't get in, which maybe in hindsight it's good, because then, you know, I kind of knew in my heart music, I had a deeper
right.
connection and passion to it. So I knew I had to make music.
Yeah.
And McMaster had fine art and also the music program. So I did a combined major, but nobody did that. So all the classes were like clashing.
Oh, no.
So I'd be like running from one art class, coming in halfway into like a music history. And I was just like, after a year of that, I was like, you know what? I love music and I want to put my all my efforts into that. And they just had a brand new program called Multimedia Startup. So I did the summer courses to catch up. And then I was able to do a multimedia and music because I wanted to learn about technology and music.
Right.
It was there at McMaster. I had Dr. Hartwell, who is lovely. And I remember having a meeting with him, sharing kind of my music, which is sort of instrumental, and thinking about my future. And he brought up Michael and Jeff Dana. So I had no idea that there were like film composers living in Ontario, let alone like Burlington, which is, you know, next door neighbor to Hamilton.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, you can become a, you know, a film or TV composer. And my music kind of naturally works with visuals. So that was kind of the natural path. But I also still, you know, love kind of the whole pop and rock and song creation. So out of university, I did some, you know, projects and, you know, did a, I think of this thesis interactive song where the song, you know, would pop up with information about at what point of the song you're in, like this is the bridge and da 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 da. And I mean, obviously in 2022, it's not, it doesn't sound really cool, but back then it was cool. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was really fun. But I also, yeah, wanted to explore performance side and stuff as well. So I continued writing, but I sort of did more of the indie band scene.
Okay.
And, you know, played in Toronto and actually, you know, got to go to China and play gigs there and, you know, met a lot of great people and went to these film and TV conferences, developing these wonderful relationships and friends.
Okay.
You know, with music supervisors and that, like Thomas Gulabich, who, you know, did all the music supervision on Breaking Bad. And like, so him and I became good friends and, you know, with a bunch of other people. And you just like, yeah, you just find your kind of tribe. And then around 2006, 2007, that's when I got in touch with composer Clint Mansell.
Right.
That kind of is when I started to shift gears and wanting to go more seriously into film and TV. But still, you know, touring with Clint Mansell has been fabulous, you know, over the last decade, you know. It's kind of like a rock band with a string quartet and then visuals of his bits of the films he worked on or even custom visuals.
Right.
So that was incredible to do that. And you learn a lot, too, when you're kind of like analyzing the music when you're performing it because you need to learn it and you can see each instrument playing their individual parts.
Yeah.
And you kind of, you see it in a different way and you learn a lot from that as well in terms of like our techniques and arrangement. And
That's a really interesting point, actually. Like, and maybe other composers, especially perhaps newer composers who are coming up and just working in a DAW, working with MIDI, working with sample instruments, or maybe a few musicians, the value of going and seeing a symphony concert for the visual aspect of like who's playing what when and how are they playing it, like just to see it happen is actually super valuable.
Yeah. And then you can even see the combination of what instruments make that sound as well. So
the way that you got in touch, the way you started your relationship with Clint Mansell, I mean, this is, you've told this story so many times, but it's such a good one. That's sort of the curse of having a great story to tell is people ask you to tell it again and again. But I mean, to me, it's one of my all-time favorites. Just in terms of the, you know, the just that it's a genuine moment that turned into something so beautiful.
Yeah, I think it was the end of 2006. And yeah, I just took a shot in the dark. And I, on that platform called MySpace, which some people might not know of, but that
it was a beautiful thing for a while there. I really feel like it was the Wild West and so much cool stuff was happening.
Yeah. And that was like before the Facebooks and all that kind of social media. So it was very cool to see and hear music that you would not normally be able to get access to. But yeah, I reached out to him, told him how his music makes me feel, you know, how much I love what he does and yada, 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 sharing what I was working on, you know, with the indie band stuff. And then, yeah, he actually replied back and I was, you know, my mind was blown. I was like, whoa. And so we started, you know, just talking about what we were working on. And he, I think he was doing a remix for The Shins or something. And I went to LA for the very first time when I was, I guess, 27. And I just said, hey, I'm going to be here for this film and TV conference. Do you want to grab a coffee? And we just like, you know, hit it off and we kept in touch. And then, yeah, like 6 months later, he needed a piano player. And because they were at the Ghent Film Festival, he's performing his works. One of those kind of door opening moments. We performed his works, and then he got the band for us to record On the Moon soundtrack,
which is one of my favorite Mansell soundtracks. That last cue when the character's going back to Earth after the big reveal of everything, you know, is such a cool. I just love that cue so much. That's one of my top film cues of all time. And you actually played on that. That you got the chance to actually perform on a Clint Mansell soundtrack.
Yeah, I played all the piano on the soundtrack, and so we also cool. performed it live to picture the whole movie with London Contemporary Orchestra. It was a 10-year anniversary in 2019. So at the Barbican, that was another experience to see it, like you're performing it live in the moment with the whole orchestra.
Right.
So that was incredible.
Did you feel like you were just like suddenly thrust into this whole new world, or because of your experience performing in bands and being in contact with people all around the world that's sort of in the business more or less, did it sort of feel like, okay, this is a sort of natural next step?
Yeah, it felt like a natural next step, and one that I was really like yearning for. You know, his music just I really connect with his music, so to be able to, you know, play, and then, you know, he had me do bits of arranging as well sometimes, so that was really, really wonderful. You know, I just feel like in life, you know, obviously it's a lot of hard work and it's dedication, yeah, and it's, you know, giving up some things and working at your craft. You're also, I feel like sometimes you're presented with these opportunities that you're ready for, and I felt like that one, even though I was freaking out all summer because I needed to learn how to use Logic. I'd never used Logic before, so in order to go down to LA to do some bits with him, I had to learn that software, and then learning the music and getting familiar with everything, and then going and actually doing the rehearsals. And
I imagine he became something of a mentor to you as well then.
For sure, yeah. Like, even if it, you know, it wasn't like the traditional like sitting in the room and doing, you know, assisting on a ton of stuff, like he would get, you know, pieces to me to do some arrangements for the piano for them. I think just like the whole live experience, like I learned a ton just being in the rehearsals and then playing the shows. Yeah, and collaboration as well. And, you know, having a string quartet and a rock band, it was kind of merging the two worlds that I love.
You're working with Clint and you're doing a lot of live stuff. And then at the same time, it sort of seems that he's helping you get into the world of trailer music. It sort of seems to be the first kind of like film-related work that you're doing. Is that right?
Well, I guess through the whole, you know, networking, as us Canadians say. You don't say the word networking in the UK.
Oh, what do they say?
They just don't say anything. You just don't say
it. Oh, they don't
say
anything. Don't say it. Don't. Oh my God, how awful. Like you're putting this dirty word onto something, right?
So I met a contact from a trailer company, and I think I was really inspired after someone reworked and reorchestrated Clint's Requiem for a Dream, and it was in the Lord of the Rings trailer, I think.
You're right.
And
yeah.
I just loved to see how, that kind of go from one place and then into a completely different, because I just like the excitement of it and the storytelling within the music in a short period of time. And then also with my solo stuff, giving that to the company for them to then pitch to try to get placements.
Cool.
And that's where we were talking earlier about like how did I self-fund, like with my solo albums, I would bank on getting one or two trailer placements to help me pay off my solo stuff, or writing trailer works and then them getting a placement and using that money to fund my solo album stuff. And like, so because you're doing, you know, doing bits and bobs, doing a documentary, doing some trailer tracks, trying to pitch for ads, like just, you know, trying to find your way to, you know, keep a roof over your head while creating music.
Sure.
I mean, I was a substitute teacher for 6 years, you know, as well, pursuing music, and that helped me to fund my own recordings and the indie band stuff. So it's just kind of finding a balance.
Oh, that's a smart way of going about it. Line of Duty, the UK's most watched drama of the 21st century. I mean, you've got this whole like, I mean, what a thing to say. And you just were nominated for a BAFTA. Huge congrats on that.
Thanks.
That's incredible. And it's now in its sixth season. That's my least favorite thing to say. Sixth.
Sibilance.
That was one of your first sort of big gigs with the in the UK, at least, with the BBC. Tell me a bit about how that came about and your process of sort of how you approached that show.
Sure, yeah. And actually this year, 2022, just marked the 10-year anniversary of Line of Duty. So it's incredible how life begins to pass in like TV series instead of chapters when you're a composer.
Oh, wow. Yeah, so no kidding.
My 30s were kind of like Line of Duty years. So, yeah, and that one, again, it's like you're working on your sound and your craft and then also kind of spreading and building your relationships with other people in the industry. When Line of Duty came up and they were looking for a composer, it started out on BBC Two, you know, kind of indie, kind of low budget cop corruption drama. Somebody I had worked on their short film, they had become head of drama at this production company. So they had thrown my name into the hat.
Ah.
And then also Clint also worked on a movie with this production company, World Productions. And they, you know, were talking with Clint and then he put my name in the hat. So I had two people sharing my name. And then that's how I got the interview. You know, it's that kind of right place, right time, because they were looking for kind of a fresh new look on that. I offered to do a little demos on some snippets of scenes that they just got, some dailies. And
okay. And
so what I presented to them, that's exactly what they were looking for. Yeah. And then it was one of those things where, you know, you're just going into it and, you know, you do your best job. And then this show and the writer, creator, Jed Mercurio, he's like a genius. He's, you know, an ex-doctor, an ex-RAF pilot, and, you know, he also can be showrunner and write one of the most incredible series. The whole show, just as the years went on, it just kind of kept gaining in popularity. And then it was like, I think season four, like with, you know, iPlayer and that, and then all these like younger generations started like just binge watching it all. And then it just kind of blew up. And it went on to BBC One. And now there's all these catchphrases that are these kind of famous sayings that people use in culture now. It's hilarious.
Yeah, that's interesting to be part of something that becomes part of the cultural fabric. This podcast is brought to you by the Screen Composers Guild of Canada, whose mission includes promoting the music, status, and rights of film, television, and media composers in Canada. Special thanks to the SOCAN Foundation for financial support. For more information on the SCGC, please visit screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. And now, back to our show. When you're pitching on something like that, and you sort of talked a little bit about this with The Innocents as well, as you were sort of going through this process. Again, you knew co-writer Hanya for 7 years before even pitching on that. And there were sort of a few more connections there. And then you have to go through this process of demonstrating why you're the right person. Is there nerves about that? How do you deal with the anxiety of going, oh, I got to get this right? How do you get inside of a show? Like, what's your process for approaching a pitch like that when it's pretty high stakes?
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of demoing because you're kind of just doing an idea sketch so early on before you know what the heart of the story is. And, you know the collaborators and the settings and everything. So I think the more time you have to steep in all those things and experiment, I think that's where the magic happens.
Right.
So I do get nervous and I get frustrated when there's a demo because I'm just like, this is not what it's going to sound like, but it's going to be something like this, you know. And then you just, you know, you're working your butt off and then sometimes you're like working on something else. So you're like just trying to balance it. And, you know, they're usually not paid. So you just don't know what's going to happen. There's a lot of unknowns. I think you just have to be yourself. You have to kind of just follow your heart and your guts. And I always say I write from my heart to hands, and then some people write from their head to their hands. So I'm very much a heart. Just try to do what you feel is best. And, you know, you have to do that by experimenting and feeding off your emotions and whatnot. With Line of Duty, once the ball got rolling and I was on the job, I kind of took a whole bunch of, I think it's a big mishmash of kind of inspiration, like, you know, Danny Elfman's Batman in the opening sequence. It's kind of, it's always this full on, very action based kind of opening. So I did a quite, you know, heavy rhythmic driven strings with some like really beautiful brass motifs and military drums, and kind of like corrupting the instruments, like the characters themselves, you know, either by putting like pianos through amplification or stretching things out or making things more dirtier and nastier. It's kind of orchestral and with electronic. And then there's a lot of emotional, you know, turmoil, and that's what the end theme, you know, people have on Twitter and YouTube, you know, bands have, you know, made different versions, which is really fun. You know, it's cool. With composing in a studio for film and TV, we don't get to see an immediate reaction from anybody. It's just us sitting alone. And even when it goes out on TV, you can't see the audience's reaction unless if you're watching that. Do you guys have Gogglebox?
No.
Over there, the TV show Gogglebox. It's a TV show about people watching TV.
What?
It's like a reality show.
Oh,
of like
my
these
God.
Different families or people, and they're watching specific TV shows that, you know, they program out. So like sometimes Line of Duty will be on it, and then you'll see all the people's reactions.
Oh, that's
it's
wild.
Really, it's fun.
So it's like a reacts to kind of, but longer form than the YouTube videos.
Yeah, yeah. And it's quite fun to watch. I've seen a lot of it, and you can hear their what? Hear their comments on things. It's like, you know, you're a fly on the wall. It's quite funny. So I've had some shows on Gogglebox, and the beauty of that is you get royalties because the music's on TV again.
Right. So a double dip. I love it.
It's always handy. But yeah, so I think with performance, like, you know, right now I'm touring with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds playing keyboards, and
yeah.
It's an immediate response. When you
yeah.
touch a key, you yeah. are hearing and seeing and smelling and feeling, you know, upwards of 90,000 people. So it's I think there's a beauty in both those situations, and I love having the balance.
By the way, I don't know if you remember this, but there's one interview with you that I read back in 2019, and they asked you, like, you know, you've done all these great things, you've had these amazing collaborators, who would you like to go next? And you put Nick Cave on that. And then when I saw that you were actually working with Nick Cave, I'm like, cool, your dream from 2019 came true. That's
well,
awesome.
Well, to be honest, it's been 3 years waiting. Because
oh,
the
man.
Pandemic, like, I was rehearsing at the beginning of 2020, you know, for a while by myself. And then the pandemic
yeah.
hit and the whole thing just disappeared. So I'm...
Were you in any way involved with his concert documentary, This Much I Know to Be True?
No, I had not worked with them when they did all that. But I just
okay.
watched it on tour. It was really beautiful. I was actually
Isn't
crying
it?
When the first music
oh
cue
my.
Came on.
Oh, my
the
God.
The Ghosteen album. I just started bawling. I'm just like, oh, my God.
That whole thing was so emotional. I mean, like, the last few cues, yeah, I was in total tears, too. I love how they started, though, with these weird, like, he's showing all his little figurines that he's making. And
yeah.
talking about what the... I was just like, what am I watching? This is amazing.
Yeah, I saw him last week. He's painting the little gold bits on them right now. It's quite a process.
Oh, that's so
great. Because I did art as well. I know how long it takes to have to...
Right.
...desculpt, and then you have to, like, put them in the kilns and fire them and then do all these layers. It's crazy. But yeah, he's such an incredible artist, like, and a human being. Like, he blows me away. They all are wonderful, and he's just incredibly funny and generous and cool. And yeah, I feel so lucky and honored to, you know, be able to work with those guys.
That's amazing.
And even the way that they perform, it's not like there's no click tracks, there's no real timelines. Like, we're kind of all playing off of Nick and kind of on your toes.
Okay.
Like, where's he gonna go? Like, one song, like, it's 5 minutes, and then the next show at the festival, it could be 8 minutes long.
Okay, wow.
Because it's quite nebulous, and we're kind of riffing off Nick.
Going back to Line of Duty for a moment, I mean, this is, we're talking about 6 seasons in 10 years. And it's interesting to hear the development of your sound. I mean, I think you're still kind of working on the similar thesis about what the show's about and how you're approaching it musically, but the sound has developed a lot. What's been your process sort of going through that? How you like, do you have a very conscious kind of thought process in terms of like, I want to get better at this, or I want to try doing this differently, or I was really inspired by XYZ and I'm going to put that in?
Yeah, I think when you have the chance to work on for something for so long, you're able to evolve the themes and the music, and there's usually a guest character each series, so being able to create new themes for that character as well. So yeah, it's been really fun to be able to kind of keep spreading and stretching the kind of original works, and still kind of reusing stuff from series one and series six, but in like new ways. Yeah, I've got some kind of modular synths kind of filtering through series six, which is really cool. My schedule was that I was going to be working on it while I was on tour, and this was before the pandemic hit. So I was actually writing a bunch of material just to the script.
Okay.
And I love doing that because it's like doing mood sketches and just thinking of the emotion and the mood and the people. And I love to do that early on and then start to work with some of those to picture. I think it's really fun and interesting way to write.
Do you have like, here's what I'd like to do next? Or like you hear something, I'm like, oh my God, that's the sound I need to get after. And do you have a process for that? Or is that just sort of an organic ongoing thing?
It's always wonderful to learn new tools because then you can kind of reinvent and kind of push your sound. And when I worked on The Rising for Sky Studios that came out this year, and that one was amazing because got to get on board way, way, way early. So having really early discussions with the director and also the music supervisor, and the music supervisor created a whole bunch of playlists of different moods so that the director and, producer and execs could look at for potential, licensing ideas and stuff. But I also was, so integrated with their process that I was getting custom sounds and synths built and exploring Ableton Live, which is a DAW that I haven't really used for scoring.
I got
Victor Chaga, who I work with to do tech stuff a lot, and so he helped me to get Ableton Live to run into Logic so I could control it from there and record it into there and manipulate and stuff. And that for me was I was able to create soundscapes that I haven't necessarily had, that kind of sound textures. And so it's been wonderful, like this, having this new rainbow of sonic scapes to play with. And
right.
I think I really love the Rising TV series, and I'm really proud of that show and the music on it. Yeah.
It's a really, really great score, available on Spotify and probably other platforms if people want to check it out. It's really worth listening to. There's these dark ambient, like as you see, lots of textural work, lots of organic kind of stuff. There's a really interesting way that you're working in the voice and vocal textures and sort of these weird sort of like loops and chops and weird glitchy stuff that really kind of like, that's interesting. It really draws you into the pieces. You mentioned getting custom synths built. Is that soft synths, or are you actually having was there a lot of hardware on that, or was it mostly in the box?
Mostly in the box, actually. Yeah, okay. It was a new way of approaching it where it was kind of pure electronic. With the character Neve, she wakes up and she's basically dead and she doesn't know. And it's like after this big rave party, nobody can see or hear her. And she's just freaking out because I guess in this kind of dimension.
A liminal space.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What I wanted to do is I wanted to kind of, even with my own sound and music, was keep within this loop of her reality. And what I did was I actually took some of my solo records and sampled those. And so I could keep within like the space of my own music as well. And
oh, wow.
Yeah. So I wanted it to kind of be an after party of one. It's kind of like a synthesized ghost. And
oh, cool.
Yeah. Being trapped in this reality of this night after the party. And the team was just incredible to collaborate with. It was one of the best, working experience I've had.
Do you use your own voice or the sound of your own voice or singing in your scores a lot?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, because I sampled my solo records and then like got those chopped up and stuff. So yeah, you will hear my vocal tones. I would like sing into my upright piano strings and like kind of vibrate them with my voice and then record those and then, you know, slap on a ton more wicked reverb. I'm not like a singer, but I think the voice can do a lot of interesting things and also add a tone that is, you know, memorable and familiar, but you can mess around with it a bit so it feels a bit odd as well. I guess because I've never played a string instrument, you could, the techniques on strings, you can bend and you can do, you know, things you can't really do with a piano. So I think going to my voice, I can like bend notes in a fairly easy way.
There's this neat thing that you mentioned in one of the interviews about singing line of duty as words to come up with sort of like an idea of where the melody could go or a rhythmic motif. Is that something you commonly do to, in order to come up with melodies to sort of sing or say the words or use mnemonics as a part of that process?
Yeah, definitely. When I was writing the end theme, I had in mind line of duty. Of course, the words don't stay there. I remove the words after. Yeah. But yeah, it can help. Like, because it's an overarching feeling I'm looking for.
Yeah.
An emotion. And I also want the sonic colors and frequencies to also make sense with the story and the characters. So I'm just trying to find that. And a lot of the times, I might be thinking of words that can describe a feeling or emotion or whatever, and use those to find a melody. But like with The Rising, I was super excited because I got to write a theme song, and then I also wrote another song. That was even from doing early sketches. My friend Martin Phipps, who composes The Crown, I go to his studio on a Steinway and just do like voice notes and stuff onto my phone. But one of those songs, like the original voice note of my vocals and piano is in the song.
Oh, cool.
Because it just captured such an emotion in that moment. And when I go to retry to do it, it's like, it sounds like cold and it doesn't sound right.
Yeah.
So sometimes you find that happening. And I think Johnny Greenwood in an interview might have said that as well. Like some of his voice notes have made it into, you know, big films and stuff. As long as you've got the emotion there, I don't really care what it's going through, you know, like,
absolutely.
I think Daft Punk used like a $99 like EQ or compressor on all of their albums, you know, it just works.
Yeah. I think there's even a story about Christina Aguilera, like one of her albums has a voice note, vocal performance on it because it was just like, she was lying underneath a coffee table having a breakdown and she just sang the song then.
Oh.
And that's what worked, and it worked. Going to The Innocents, which is a really cool sci-fi show on Netflix, and you're a big sci-fi fan. I think that was a lot of fun for you to work on because of that. One of the cool things that I realized sort of had happened with that was that, you know, you had this relationship with the LCO that you sort of probably started developing when you were working with Mansell in the early days. And now you've got the chance to actually work with them, record them at AIR, and really have this kind of like intimate relationship. And you said working with Robert Ames, he came to you and you sort of did a viola workshop, and you have this amazing sort of like feedback loop of the LCO giving you feedback on your own ideas. Tell me a bit more about that, because I think that's a very wonderful way to work. And actually, to me, it sounds like the way composers used to work before a reference material was available. You could go to your computer and go, this is what this sounds like, and this is a nice range for this. You'd have to actually go and sit down with an actual person and go, show me what your instrument does.
Yeah, they have such a wealth of knowledge of all of these incredible techniques. They have brought just people in general that might not have ever heard any, you know, experimental music or 20th century music, or they've kind of, they've made it really cool and, you know, they've really opened it up and you know, they collaborate with artists and stuff. And I love that they're bringing all this new stuff to the world. And, you know, with Spitfire Audio, you know, they've done a couple samplers with them. And so it's incredible that you have access now as a music writer to be able to do these techniques that I've never seen that. And with samplers before. So it's just widened the palette, I think, for music creators. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was wonderful. And just, having the conversations and then sitting in my studio, with Rob and like going through these ideas and then capturing them. And then I could like mess around with them. And then when we go and record the whole ensemble, we've got kind of our arsenal ready, the key ideas that we want to make sure we get. So I love sci-fi stuff. So for me, it was a super no-brainer you know, dream of a project for me. I guess I grew up watching like The X-Files, you know, Mulder and Scully. And so I've always loved them so much and always looking for ways that I can, you know, make my Mulder and Scully music, which I kind of pretend I do when I'm doing Line of Duty. I pretend that I'm writing for the police version of them.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
With Kate and Steve, the main characters. And the fact that they were open to get big epic sound and also be experimental. That was incredible. And then writing, you know, a theme song. I collaborated with a Norwegian artist, Anna-Lena Bruland, who goes by the name of Ira. And the way it came about, it was very last second because I had written this end theme song and it, you know, with strings and it was beautiful and it worked. But then when I thought of these lyrics one night and it was like, you know, midnight sitting at the piano and I started writing these lyrics to it and I started bawling my eyes out and I'm like, wow. Okay, something's here. So usually when I cry, I know I'm onto something.
Yeah.
I sound like I'm like a tortured composer, but I'm very much kind of a method composer where I really dive deep and I really get my head almost obsessed with the characters and the story and the project. So I had got those lyrics together. When I presented them using just my demo vocals, they were just like, oh yeah, this is really great. This is really epic, but they need it by like, you know, 2 days from now. So,
oh boy.
Yeah. I had a chat with Martin Phipps and he had mentioned working with Ira and she's also Norwegian and the whole show is like, you know, half based in Norway. And it was just,
and she's just down the hall.
And then, well, she was like, she lived down the street from me as well. It was the weirdest thing. And like, so right. she came over and I don't know how she did it, but I wrote this extremely high jump, you know, with the melody and she just hits it. And I'm like, oh my God, it's perfect. The LCO got us to perform a suite of The Innocents as part of the BBC proms at Royal Albert Hall, and it was the sci-fi proms, and like so for us to be standing on the stage with LCO orchestra, you know, performing at this prestigious concert and being a sci-fi one as well, I was like, that was one of the best nights of my life.
Oh wow, I can't imagine.
And she nailed it, man. It was so good.
Oh wow. Yeah, the BBC proms, I mean, it just doesn't really get much bigger than that, you know. And Royal Albert Hall, it's your Carnegie Hall right there. Yeah, you know, you've made it. That's incredible. Wow.
Yeah, it was so amazing. Beautiful.
And the LCO, I think, also makes an appearance on your own album, Nothing Is Something. Is that right?
For Nothing Is Something, I brought Rob over. We recorded Strings and Brass, actually, in Budapest. Okay. But Rob came over and, yeah, you know, arranged and conducted. And then I worked with Galia, his partner, and she's also, like, you know, the lead violinist of the LCO, so she also played solo on one of my pieces. Yeah, that was a very collaborative album.
I mean, if we want to talk about epic again, like, I mean, in terms of how long it took, 7 years in the making, and just the dynamic range of the album and the eclectic sort of like different sounds and instrumentation and approaches and genres that you're sort of going, and everything fits together really well. Like it all sounds like it's very much coming from the same place, but it's very rare, I find, to find albums where people really go to those, like, to, okay, here's the biggest kind of orchestral thing we can do. And then here's more of a, like an electronic song, like a song, not so much instrumental. It's an absolutely gorgeous album. I really recommend people check it out.
Oh,
and so interesting. It's shifting and changing and sort of giving you a new perspective on each piece, but in a way that, again, feels very integrated. I mean, how did you manage to do that over 7 years?
Yeah.
Like, how does that all hold together?
I think, you know, when I have my, you know, some off time, I'll be sketching little doodles and ideas, and I keep folders of these ideas. Yeah. And some of them, they really resonate with me. And I'm like, I must develop that. I love this. Or,
okay,
you know, songs or whatever it is. So I've kind of collected those. And then as, you know, my work kind of ramped up, I was getting less and less time to do this. So I had to find a chunk of time and space where I had the time to do that. And it did take quite a while, and then you need to like finesse stuff and then record it and mix it. So yeah, it's the kind of ideas over the, you know, the prior 7-8 years. But I think, like I mentioned with the Elton John Yellow Brick Road, that gave me the, you know, confidence that I can make an album that's kind of a pop album, but it's also kind of orchestral and cinematic, and it's kind of epic, and it's kind of electronic, and you know, heck, if I want to do like a piece of just all strings and then it goes into like strings with beats, then I'm going to do it. And then the next song has, you know, vocals on it. And yeah, I just went for it. And I think that's the beauty of albums. You can,
oh yeah,
no rules.
Was this something you felt you had to make? Or was there also a thought of like, here's an opportunity for me to express something that I might not be able to get to do on film and TV projects that will demonstrate or show something other, some other aspect of my musical personality?
Yeah, I think both. Like, yeah, it's just making music for music, and I'm telling the story within the music, and they're my stories. Right. So for me, it is a kind of a therapeutic thing where I'm, you know, working through, yeah, experiences or emotions, or it might be, I think, like The Crushing Weight of History, which Jonas Bjer of the band Mew sings on, because he's one of my favorite singers. That, you know, I wrote those lyrics after walking up and down this big rock in Cefalù in Sicily, seeing all the layers of the history and these buildings going from kind of like the gods to like different eras of Christianity, like, and then war, and like seeing it through architecture in these rocks of,
oh wow,
of all this history that's happened in that spot. You know, it is an expensive calling card, but I, you know, it does get me work as well.
Okay. So the response has been positive in terms of like people finding it and going, oh, this is cool. You know, cause not a lot of composers really do that. I mean, unless they're, you know, someone like, I don't know, like a Sarah Sleen, where they're also, before that, they were established singer-songwriter.
Yeah.
Don't tend not to make albums as much because, I don't know, I guess we're all, we're kind of as a species, we're very like, oh, no, no, I'm here to serve. I don't want to say anything too loud or offend anybody.
Yeah, I guess I'm really weird in that I'm kind of straddling, like, album world and film, TV, scoring world, like I just, they're two very important things to me and I never want to lose either of them. Like this is just a natural progression for me to express musical ideas and express myself. And then I can use this music to then share on demo reels for another project, or I might be able to get a placement in a trailer and that will help me to fund the next album.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful exercise and it's fun and it's scary and beautiful. And
how do you deal with the voices? Like, I don't know, like, again, you're sort of talking early days coming from Hamilton, Toronto, doing the indie rock music scene. I find that scene very intimidating because it's so much about what's cool and doing things in an ironic way. And yeah, you can go for it, but only to this level. And then it's, then you're being too earnest and too into it. And I'm like, I'm a really earnest guy. I like just kind of turning it up to 11 if that's how I feel, you know. And that's something I really appreciate about your album is that, you know, you're just going for it. You're like, okay, let's turn this up. We're going to go for it. And that's really inspiring for me because I'm like, oh yeah, you can do this. That's a permission thing. But do you wrestle with that? Do you have sort of a combat with voices that are not your own or imagined voices, what people might think, and squashing that, that true voice that is your musical identity?
You know what? I think maybe if you asked me that 15 years ago, I'd say yes.
Okay.
But I think I've just been doing this for so long now. And I just feel like I've always been kind of an indie kind of mentality. Like I never signed with a record label. I've always done everything myself. And it's like, you know, I write all the music for all the projects I work on. And so I think that's just been my process. And at this stage, I don't care anymore. Like I want to make music. And if it makes me feel something, then I've kind of won, I guess. And then I share it. And then if one person likes it, that's amazing. But
that's great.
I think it's important to follow your heart. I mean, obviously, when you're working to picture, you're working in a collaborative team and getting notes and revising. And that's cool because you're writing music for a specific story. With albums, it's 100% your vision and voice. Does that answer the question?
I think so. I mean, I like that. You know, if you got yourself and you got to that feeling, you know, you got to something where it actually meant something to you or it had a genuine emotional reaction that it brought out of you, then you've won. I really like that idea because ultimately, what else? Like, you're just hunting after a ghost otherwise, right? There's no, like, it's an impossible target to hit because you don't know who you're writing it for after a while.
Yeah, yeah. I think you have to just be genuine and authentic with yourself and write stuff for yourself because at the end of the day, when you're going to bed, hit your head on the pillow, there's nothing worse than, like, thinking of, like, oh, man, you know, I'm not proud or 100% behind that music because I'm trying to sound like so-and-so or whatever. Like, obviously, we all are inspired and we take bits of everything of all music of all history. But yeah, I think you just have to kind of be true to what makes you happy.
Anything that's sort of been on your mind, a message you want to get out there, or a soapbox moment for yourself, or just something that's been obsessing you?
I don't know. I think my mind's been quite occupied, like, you know, being on tour with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, which is one of them, another incredible experience of my lifetime, and being able to fly to all these different countries. I think there's 26 different countries we're going to, and you're kind of a part of a clan, and you're traveling, and you're all sharing in this experience of connecting with people live and also each other on stage. And I don't know if there's any other high that, you know, natural high that can match that, because for me, it's just all my favorite things together in one place.
Yeah. And
so, yeah, I'm just really, really soaking it up right now, touring and enjoying it, and then kind of thinking maybe it's time to start writing another album. I'm starting to get that itch. You know, in general, I get asked a lot about, you know, breaking into the whole industry and that. And I just think it's, you know, if it's something that you absolutely love and passionate about, then you have to just persevere. And, you know, your work ethic and clever ways of balancing the work with being able to pay the rent, because it's obviously, it doesn't happen overnight. It's something that you have to continue to work at and develop your skills and find out what your strengths are. Do it because you love it. Don't do it for money or anything, or else you're going to be unhappy.
Yeah. And don't be afraid to send someone who you admire a love letter and see where it takes you.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't be afraid to ask, and don't be afraid to reach out. The only thing could be not getting a response or a no, and that's okay. Not everybody is available at all the times, right? I find that you attract yourself to similar vibes of creative people. And even when I worked on The Rising, when I met Ed Lilly, the director, like, we were both wearing the same outfit. Like, I was just like, I like you already. So you just kind of like vibe with people, and you sort of, end up finding your little circle of people that it makes sense to create with. And that takes time, right? It takes time, experience, sure. and hard work and all that. But don't give up after like a year. You know, it took me many years to get to a place where I had regular work, like many, many years. So
I guess the last question would be, where can people follow you online and find out what you're up to?
Oh, yeah, I've got Instagram at Carly Paradis. And the same with Twitter.
Well, Carly, this has been so much fun and really interesting to dive into your catalog and the things you've been working on, all this inspiring travels and journeys that you've been on creatively. So thanks so much for spending the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can support us by giving the show a 5-star rating and sharing the episodes and tagging us at Screen Composers. We'd love to hear from you, so drop us a line at tscs@screencomposers.ca. For more information on the SCGC, please visit www.screencomposers.ca and follow us online at Screen Composers. The Screen Composers Studio is produced by myself, Adrian Ellis. Editing, graphics, audio, and video post-production by Nick Grimshaw. Special thanks to our Managing Director, Tanya Dedrick, as well as the SOCAN Foundation for financial support.